Et pour Imola, Breeze Rise. Ohea oko e ko ka aha, i ngahe kuriana i mua o kea aha, ho kolokolo ki e hanahano o ka moku aina o Hawaii, e nai mai, e malio mai, i lohi ia ka leo. Hiri, hiri, hiri. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. E noho i lau, please be seated.
Belina, makamoku puni o Oahu, kamoko kona e ano kako, make kula kanawai o William S. Richardson. Ka aheo ka aha ika noho o polopolo ana I Kenya la. Greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at the William S. Richardson School of Law. The court is honored to be here today. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000641. Steve F. Loyola and Ty Aaron Medeiros, petitioners, appellants, appellants versus County of Hawaii, respondent, appellee, appellee. Arguing for petitioners, Ted Hong. Arguing for respondents, Deputy Corporation Counsel, Mark Disher. Argument on the merits.
Thank you. Aloha hihaiki and good evening. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Clarissa Malinow of the First Circuit. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. Just to confirm, Mr. Hong, I understand you'll argue for 20 minutes, then reserve your remaining time for rebuttal. And Mr. Disher, you will have 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning. Thank you. Mr. Hong, please proceed.
May it please the court. Chief Justice McKenna, Associate Justices, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hong, representing the petitioners, retired Battalion Chief Steve Loyola, who is in the gallery, and retired Battalion Chief Ty Medeiros, who is also in the gallery. There are two issues before the court. First, raised by the petitioners, did the petitioner suffer a disciplinary or adverse action by humiliating them among their peers and excluding them from regularly scheduled overtime pay while on indefinite leave with pay? The second raised by the court was the court had asked us, what is the legal standard governing adverse employment actions in the context of free speech retaliation under Article 1, Section 4 of the Hawaii State Constitution? The broader framework that I'd like to point out or begin with this afternoon is the courts are the appropriate forum to decide constitutional issues. That's the HOH Corporation case at 69 Hawaii 135-142.
Hold on for just a second. Mr. Claro.
Apologies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just as a side note, it's unusual for me to sit down and speak to the court. So I beg your, indulgence. The HOH Corporation case, 69 Hawaii 135 at page 142, it basically says that administrative agencies don't have the authority to decide constitutional issues. In this particular case.
What year was that?
HOH Corporation versus Motor Vehicle Industrial Licensing Board, DCCA.
What year was it?
Oh, I'm sorry, 1987.
All right. Don't we have some cases after that have at least said that agencies also have an obligation to consider Native Hawaiian traditional and customary rights under the Hawaii Constitution?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the Sandy Beach line of cases. You get into the public trust doctrine and these other issues. And so this is kind of what I like to describe as apples and orangutans. I mean, it's completely different circumstances. So I appreciate the court asking the question. In terms of due process, there are three areas in which my clients have a due process right to their continued employment. the Minton versus Quintal case, which gives a liberty interest in their continued employment. That's 131 Hawaii 167 at pages 185 to 186. Then the second area is recently the intermediate court issued a decision called Slayton versus State, 115 Hawaii 312 at 320 through 321. That stands for the proposition that a public sector employee's retirement benefit is a property or liberty interest. And then again, as my clients were excluded employees, they qualified under 89C-2, subsection 3 of the Hawaii Vice Statutes, meaning the murder principle, and that analysis would apply to them. In this particular case...
Counsel, can I ask you, what was the reason of putting them on paid leave to begin with? Was it in connection of performing the investigation, or couldn't the investigation have been done without putting them on paid leave and allow them to continue acting in their capacity as battalion chiefs? Because that's a pretty high rank, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And they could have done that. And our theory of the case is that they intentionally did that to punish them, to exclude them from the regularly scheduled overtime, and also that would affect their retirement. Because the court knows under 88-160, it says that your retirement or their retirement is based
on... And I understand. I don't mean to cut you off. I apologize. But there was some question about whether or not the OT was almost guaranteed or not. And that's my word, but set in advance. And there's testimony that the BC scheduled it and it just kind of gets rubber stamped by the assistant chief. Is that the procedure?
That's correct, Your Honor. I appreciate your bringing that up. Part of the confusion in this case is that the overtime mirrored what was in the collective bargaining agreement.
The rank for rank?
The rank for rank policy. That's at docket 23, PDF page 97, bait stamp 00711. And again, that's apples and orangutans. And the reason is that in the collective bargaining agreement for rank to rank, there's two requirements. The employer has to offer overtime, and the employees in advance have to say they're available for overtime. In this particular case, they didn't have to get an approval. They didn't have to get assigned. They self-scheduled their overtime at least a month and a half, a month earlier. They just said, this is how the schedule for battalion chiefs are going to go, including rank to rank.
Did they go all 12 shifts, 288 hours? How much did they pre-schedule?
I don't believe there's somewhere in the record, and I apologize, Justice Edmonds, for not having it offhand, but the Chief Rosario actually bumped that number up because, as you pointed out, they were bumping up against the regular number or the number set by the collective bargaining agreement. So he issued a memorandum saying now he's going to increase the amount of overtime. So the battalion chiefs could actually continue to do that their regularly scheduled overtime on a regular basis.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out is what was truly regularly scheduled. What was scheduled versus what might be scheduled based on past year's practice?
The past practice was to have battalion chief always online, always there, always ready. And because they were short, another battalion chief would have to step in. They would either work a double shift until they were relieved by another battalion chief or somebody who would.
So it sounds like nothing was truly scheduled. It's kind of up in the air. If a battalion chief is not there, we go for our rank for rank. So nothing was like, all right, June we're scheduled for, August we're scheduled for, next September we're ready to go. None of that happened?
No, Your Honor, I have to disagree. It was exactly as you described
earlier. Okay, I'm not sure. I want you to tell me what's on the record.
Yeah, what is in the record, and it's in Battalion Chief Ty Medeiros' testimony, docket 17, PDF pages 22 to 23, line 7 through 10 of the transcript. He talks about that specifically, that it was always scheduled, it was turned into the administration, and they rubber stamped.
Had they rubber stamped it this time?
Yes, they rubber stamped it this time. They always rubber stamped it. So it's not a matter of, okay, I'm the deputy chief or the chief. We got a hole in February. So who can fill the hole in February? It's not like that at all. What happens is the battalion chiefs work it out and they say, okay, for February, here it is. For March, here it is.
Had overtime been scheduled already for your clients that was taken away because they were placed on admin leave with pay,
Yes. In fact,
put on MND with pay.
So in November, when Battalion Chief Medeiros was summoned from West Hawaii to Hilo, he was driving his fire department car. And because he was suspended by Chief Rosario, everything stopped, including his use of the fire department car. He had to catch a ride back to Kona based on what Chief Rosario did. So everything stopped. Overtime, any benefits, they were automatically stopped.
Counsel, because he had the puka with the BC then, were they almost always going to get something scheduled because they were down one battalion chief?
Yes. And Battalion Chief Medeiros, docket 17, PDF page 26 through 27, line 16 through 14, he testified that had they not filled that puka because he was gone, he would have gotten.
So you are arguing then that the merit appeals, the county merit appeals board, when they ruled that the chief had complete discretion to just that they weren't going to get the overtime. It was totally the chief's discretion. Are you arguing that that finding is clearly erroneous?
I look at it from a different perspective. If I'm the battalion chief, I get regularly scheduled overtime. That's just written in stone. And for the chief to take that away from me, our argument is that's part of three retaliatory actions that they took against my client. The other retaliatory actions were taking away the badge and the insignia that was written, which is very well briefed, I think. And also,
was that done for both of your clients in front of other people?
Yes. So for example, although Battalion Chief Loyola wasn't present at the time, there was another fire captain, John Whitten, who testified that he saw the deputy chief remove the bugles and the rank insignia from Battalion Chief Loyola's shirt. That's docket 34, PDF page 14.
So isn't there a recording of his stripping of the rank as well?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was with Battalion Chief Medeiros. When he was summoned to come into Hilo, he went into the office, chief's office, the chief, the deputy chief. There was another administrator and the chief secretary who on an iPad recorded the whole incident.
Conduct of itself of recording, is that part of standard operating procedures in these kind of cases?
No, even Chief Rosario admitted in his testimony before the Merit Appeals of the Civil Service Commission that was the first time it ever happened.
Did it continue from there? I mean, he can start a practice anytime, but did it start from that point on and continue, or was that the only one time?
That
they videotaped someone getting stripped of their badge.
That was, I think, the only time that ever happened.
Can I go back to the overtime? And I apologize for beating a dead horse, but what about the argument they're saying that they weren't really denied overtime, they just weren't available? That's the counter to that. In other words, they weren't denied OT. They were just not available to accept OT.
But yeah, I have a hard time with that one too, Your Honor, and I apologize.
I'm just presenting with
I understand their argument completely. And the reason why I have a hard time doing that is they made them unavailable. They literally said, you're cut off. You can't do anything related to the fire department. Because they're on paid leave.
So, Mr. Hong, a lot of this discussion, though, is what the effect of the action was putting them on admin leave. The Merit Appeals Board issue that was defined for the parties, though, the question was, did the employer, the fire department, violate any statutes, rules, regulations, or personnel policies in putting them on leave? I haven't heard anything about that. What I'm not even sure if it was argued. So I'm just wondering if we're kind of like sidestepping the issue that was actually before the Merit Appeals Board.
The due process issue was not before the Merit Appeals Board, and I submit that the due process issue cannot be decided by an administrative agency.
That's your reference to the HOH Corporation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That a constitutional issue cannot be adjudicated by an administrative agency.
That's correct, Your Honor. And aside from that, when you look at the Merit Appeals Board and how it happened, the burden of proof was on us to prove that the department did something wrong. If this was treated under the merit principle and the just cause checklist, the actual opposite would happen. That the department would now have to prove what they did was legitimate.
Well, there's a separate lawsuit though, right? Isn't there also a separate lawsuit brought by your clients? And I'm trying to understand in your view where these issues should be decided, because my understanding is it's like sort of like a whistleblower retaliation claims that are asserted in that separate lawsuit initiated in circuit court, right?
That's correct.
So shouldn't these issues about retaliation and whether the putting them on admin leave for retaliatory purposes shouldn't be decided there? How does it fit into the Merit Appeals Board proceeding?
And thank you for asking that question, because this brings up the larger issue from our perspective, is that we're not just seeking a remedy for my clients in terms of a circuit court action, like a whistleblower case. What we're trying to say that is under Chapter 89C of the Hawaii Vice Statutes, all excluded employees who are entitled to regularly scheduled overtime, have a due process right in terms of, you know, that income, revenue, and as a result, what we're saying before the court is we're asking for a broader rule.
Don't you have to show that somehow the fire department violated a statute, rule, regulation, or a personalized policy in terms of putting them on admin leave? I mean, we haven't talked about it, but there's a reason why they were put on admin leave, or at least from the fire department's perspective, right? It's not like they just out of thin air decided to put them on there. There were letters written and critiques and in the view of the fire department, statements made against the chief that were perhaps that violated their own regulation. So my question is, don't you need to show a violation of a statute, rule, regulation in order to succeed before the Merit Appeals Board, which is where this appeal starts from?
And my response is no. So if I look at, for example, the GEMA case that Justice Devens wrote, when he talks now about how a substandard evaluation could be considered disciplinary or could be considered an adverse action, what we're saying is that in terms of an adverse action, this would actually fall under that as well for exempt employees under Chapter 89C.
So the issue that was specifically articulated by the Merit Appeals Board is irrelevant to us at this point? When the appeal arises from that proceeding? I'm trying to understand that.
Yes. Yes, it is irrelevant. And the reason why is under 9114G1, right, you can raise or appeal a violation of a constitutional law violation or a statutory law violation. We're here contending, and we've done that through the circuit court, the intermediate court, and now you, that this was a constitutional violation in terms of what happened to my client.
But you're alleging due process. Now, initially, your clients both raised free speech violation, free speech retaliation as claims, but you didn't specifically raise it at the Merit Appeals Board or the Circuit Court or the ICA. We ordered supplemental briefing on the issue, but going back to what this is, a Merit Appeals Board proceeding, under 76-14, it says that employees under Chapter 76 excluded from collective bargaining, suffering legal wrong under subsection 4, which is employment actions under this chapter, including disciplinary actions and adverse actions for failure to meet performance requirements, right? And the county is saying they didn't meet performance requirements because they didn't go through the proper channels and they made their complaints public. But when you look at 76.1, the merit principle, it talks about how the purpose of the merit principle is to select people based on fitness and ability for public employment and retain employees based on their demonstrated appropriate conduct and productive performance. And the purpose of the chapter is also to build a career of service in government free from coercive political influences, to render impartial service to the public at all times according to the dictates and ethics and morality and in compliance with all laws. So you are sitting here arguing that the Merit Appeals Board cannot consider, I'm getting a little bit confused because now you're saying they can consider due process constitutional issues. But are you arguing that the Merit Appeals Board can, compliance with all laws would not include constitutional protections, that the Merit Appeals Board cannot consider constitutional protections? Is that your argument?
Yes.
So you're saying that those issues have to be reserved for the circuit court to decide?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is that that's your charge. That's your duty to interpret our Constitution, not volunteers at the level of an agency, administrative agency.
Okay. All right. So you're saying that the Merit Appeals Board should just consider the rules or personnel policies, but no matter what they decide, then it's up to someone to file an appeal with a circuit court for the circuit court of the ICA or our court to address the constitutional issues.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would point out that under the doctrine of sua sponte in error, this court has on 8 different occasions from 1949 taken up issues where the parties either don't identify or brief.
These are merits appeals board cases?
No, they run the gamut in terms of...
Oh, we've done it much more than 8 times since 1949, I assure you.
That's the only ones that I can find, Your Honor. The one I wanted to highlight was the plain error doctrine that started in 1950 with City and County versus TAMC, 38 Hawaii 592. Then you're aware of the Cox versus Cox case that Justice Pollack wrote. And then the latest was the Hack versus University of Hawaii case, which actually changed or redefined the elements of intentional infliction of emotional distress, but none of the parties raised that particular issue. So the court does have a history where they can bring up a particular case. And I know one of the issues was, why didn't we bring the free speech issue up at the Merit Appeals Board or at the lower court? So I want to admit, it was strategic. And the reason why it was strategic is because the Garcetti case is very clear that when public employees, pursuant to their official duties, say something or speak out about something, the First Amendment doesn't apply to them. When I read the Crosby...
But we're not bound by that.
Well, I was going to get into the Crosby case by Justice Klein. Justice Klein adopted the Connick framework, which adopts also that private citizen versus when a public employee as a private citizen speaks out on a particular topic. You know, Justice Klein did note that despite the 8 complaints that he made, Mr. Crosby made, nothing happened to him. In this case, why that's different is what happened to my clients was once they made the complaint, and here's now the suspension letter or the indefinite investigation letter, administrative leave, they were prohibited from saying anything, even if they were a private citizen. That letter says they can't talk about anything. So, you know, I go back to the In re Kahea case that Justice Edmonds wrote. One of the things that we would ask for is this whole dichotomy between a public employee speaking out as a private citizen be done away with, because the 3-part test in In re Kahea actually, to me, protects those interests. And I would note that I'm a...
Well, before you sit down, Tom, you know, I mean, isn't this case really just your stalking horse for a claim preclusion on your whistleblower matter? I mean, aren't you really seeking that? I mean, that's what you want us to rule, right?
No,
you're... Then you go up in the Third Circuit and say that it has claim preclusion effects.
No.
Right?
I would disagree, Your Honor. And the reason why I disagree is because my clients have never said that they're in this for the money. And they're saying that they just want compensation to make them whole. And if this case makes them whole, that circuit court case goes away. So
would it have claim preclusion effects?
I think you could argue it both ways.
Did anyone make a demand for jury trial in that case?
We did, yes, Your Honor. I think...
Which gives the county the right to the jury trial, too, if you made the demand, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And we'll give you more time, too, so no worries there. But, you know, since you brought it up and brought up Garcetti, and, you know, the official duty, which As Justice McKenna alluded to, we obviously do not have to follow that. We have our Article 1, Section 4, state constitutional prerogative there. But you, I sense, disagree with the official duty, official capacity prong of Garcetti. Is that right?
I agree.
And let me ask you this then. Connecticut came out with a case called Truth, T-R-U-S-Z. It sort of riffs off of Justice Souter's concurrence in Garcetti. Is that an acceptable standard in your mind?
I apologize that I did not read that case in preparation for argument today. I would only note that it is difficult, I think, for any state employee who notices corruption or any other thing to sit silently and go, okay, today I'm going to go off on Saturday and use my Wi-Fi at Starbucks and, you know, write a letter to the editor. They should be able to express their concerns. And I would note that I think in the three-part test that you articulated in Ray Cahill, where you have to show some kind of personal animosity, I think that covers the situation, that helps the situation, that, okay, engage in constitutional activity, then can now, if we're now going to single you out and do something against you, that's when I
think. But isn't the public employment context a little bit different in that you certainly when those who go into public service give up some of their free speech rights that members of the public, like in the Kaya situation, might not?
That's true. And that's why I think the third part of your test of regarding personal animosity now says that, okay, if, you know, Ted Hong is department director, and I didn't like what, you know, Frank Smith said, I'm going to nail him, and I can prove the personal animosity issue. I think that covers it. I think that...
Why should personal animosity be a requirement, though?
Because in this particular case, for example,
a substantial or motivating factor was the element, not necessarily personal animosity. That personal animosity went to the substantial motivating factor.
Right. And I would note very quickly that when you look at Sean Summers' testimony, fire captain with the department 21 years, he spoke to the media, TV, he spoke to the, wrote letters to the West Hawaii Today, he wrote letters to the commission, he was given a letter of investigation, he was never put on administrative leave, he was never suspended, they dropped the investigation, nothing happened to him. But when you look at my clients, what happened to him was Chief Rosario singled them out, wanted to send a message, and that's why we're here today. And I reserve my 5 and some odd seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Disher.
Yeah. Can you just discuss this? As was aptly pointed out before the map, there was actually two that was presented before. There was the one where did the employer's fire department countywide violating executive building regulations, personal policies when appellants based on administrative leave with pay for the purpose of having an investigation. The second issue is, what's the remedy? Now, that's actually important because in Chapter 76, there's limited remedies that the MAP could have done in this manner. Actually, none in this manner. They can, under 76-47E, it limits the MAP's authorities to employees that were suspended, discharged, or demoted, and who are not included in appropriate bargaining unit under Section 89-6. Now, suspension is the question. Under 76-45 includes suspension of pay. Discharge and demotions also defined under 76-46. And none of those occur here. Both appellants retain their ranks at the time, chiefs that are not demoted. In fact, when Town Chief Medeiros was ordered to return to work, he returned to work as the Town Chief. Battalion Chief Laloya was, though he did not return to work and went on sick leave, he retained his rank of Battalion Chief until his retirement. There was no promotion. There was also concern that there was any negative I was put in their personnel records. Nothing was put in the personnel records. This is more of the long lines of the email, which would be the concern of any kind of permanent record that could affect your future prospects.
So, so back pay in the overtime context would never be available as a remedy through the Merit Appeals Board.
In this circumstances, they're limited to, well, there's no denial of benefit. They also have retained benefits. Now, there was the argument that they should have received speculative amounts of overtime pay, which is a problem because these numbers that repeatedly show up in all the briefings, there's...
If it was a true loss, though, the board could award. If overtime was actually lost.
If overtime was actually lost, and not in this scenario, because they were on paid administrative leave, they're not available for overtime. And that's the issue.
The county made them unavailable.
Right.
Okay.
Pending investigation.
Right.
I mean, this is actually the same negotiated a tool that's in the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, to be able to place a firefighter, regardless of rank, on paid administrative leave pending investigation.
Councils, what would be the purpose from the county's perspective then of the act of stripping an individual's badge and recording it? What purpose would that serve?
Now, the badge is issued by the department, is a symbol of their authority and rank. And if they're on paid administrative leave, they do not have that authority at that time while on paid administrative leave. One of the problems was the abuse of authority and how they acted with, they are higher ranking. These aren't average firefighters sitting around the firehouse, gossiping. These were high-ranking officers in the department,
but
that had influence.
But this is a chain of command, paramilitary structure, and to take someone's badge away—that's a pronounced effect, especially on a battalion chief.
It's
not that simple to say they didn't lose any benefits. They lost the stature of being the battalion chief for that period of time. They're unpaid. Administrative leave, was it 6-7 months?
And the only reason why it was that long was actually the length and breadth of the allegations they present that were also investigated. Otherwise, the investigation probably would have been much shorter.
Okay, but you started with the premise they really didn't lose anything, but they did lose that status once that badge was taken away from them. They lost their ability to command at that point, didn't they?
Well, administratively, yes, you lose your ability to command. That's the purpose.
You don't have your authority at that point.
There's no authority.
Right.
And so the badge merely at that point is a symbol of that authority.
I just heard you say that they were on paid administrative leave for 6 or 7 months, not just because they were being investigated, but their allegations against the chief were being investigated, and therefore they could not return to work while the allegations against the chief were being investigated?
So I would argue that in this case, I believe that if anything, the department was overly cautious. It's like, okay, they're presented with...
Is this normal departmental policy? If someone makes a complaint about a superior, they are placed on paid administrative leave while the superior is being investigated?
Arguably, this is not... normal, just that the fact that any violations of the fire department regulations, rules and regulations, can potentially lead to being placed in paid administrative leave.
Would you concede that such a policy is quite chilling against free speech?
No, I would not say so, because they are still retaining their rank. They still retain
They lose their badge, they lose their car, they're humiliated in front of their peers, and that's not chilling.
That's not chilling, because these individuals, if anything, were not deterred. It's the abuse of their rank is what the problem. It not necessarily the content of the letters, it was the conduct that was being under investigation. The only reason the content was important in the MABS analysis in this case was to help explain the length of the investigation. Over 20 interviews, some interviews, 106-page report. It took some time. And it was a third party. It wasn't an internal investigation. So if anything, the department is very, very careful in trying to keep This is above board.
How so? Is it the practice that if a firefighter makes a complaint, they get put on paid leave if they make the complaint against somebody else?
No, actually, it's, complaints or recommendations for improvement in the department is actually in the rules and regulations. It's recommended you put that up the chain of command.
Okay, but part of the paid leave was the complaints that these two battalion chiefs initiated against the chief. And so that's being investigated, and they're on part of that paid leave is because of their complaint?
It's where now we're going to split hairs at this point because it's in their intertwined. I mean, really, it's the conduct, which was this laundry list of largely unsubstantiated complaints made by these two officers.
Well, you can expedite and say, we'll investigate their portion of the complaints first, get them off paid leave and put them back, and then we'll do the rest after that. I mean, that could be done.
I cannot speak as to what happened 10 years ago at this point. And that's another problem.
Why did this take so long? Did it get stuck at circuit court? It seems like there was 5 years at circuit court.
It looks like it's stuck in circuit court. Maybe COVID can explain part of that delay, but not all of it. I do not know what happened. I know it bounced from a Kelo judge to a Kona judge at some point. I do not know why it took so long. And that's one of the problems I see with the primary jurisdiction doctrine. I think once maybe some clarity could be occur there. Once the decision is made at the agency, circuit court case proceeds. But yes, they can still appeal. That'll be going on. But justice delayed is justice denied.
Counsel, when you reference the topic of conduct, and in this particular case, and looking at the record below, certainly there's been a process in place regarding the chain of command. And there was a written letter, and perhaps the county can concede to this, that was sent to the then mayor presiding, and then also to the commission. And so is the conduct itself, not so much the express substance of what was written therein contained in those letters, but also the fact that the chain of command was not followed?
That's largely what the fire department rules and regulations indicates. You use your chain of command. Anyway, it all goes down. And what they did is basically deviate from. The commission is basically the fire chief's boss, so basically they're going over his head. And obviously the mayor as the head executive of the county.
How many steps are there between the chief and a battalion chief?
There's assistant chiefs, deputy chiefs, and then the assistant chief.
But when an employee in their employed capacity working for the state learns about information that is of a public matter, private citizen concern, what is the opportunity for that employee to take their concerns in the manner in which they did? And this goes to Justice McKenna's point, as well as the other justices, to the extent of their queries as to what chilling effect that the rules and regulations presently by the county as it relates to an opportunity of how they can exercise protected speech.
Well, yes, okay. This is, I guess it depends also on, how the messages get taken. County Chief Laloya, 10, 11 months before his letter was written, testified in front of the department. There's some not kind things said at that time. He was not put under investigation. Presumably, he was acting as a citizen testifying on that matter. It's when he basically is using his rank to say, hey, I'm a battalion chief, and these, you need to fire the fire chief. And the way he went about it, the conduct, what was placed under investigation. Same for Battalion Chief Medeiros. This court has not adopted Garcetti. Using that analysis, that was actually more right on point. It was on fire department letterhead, memorandum sent up the chain, just that he included members outside the chain. Now, this conduct overall will erode the good order and discipline.
And isn't that your point? And answering some of the questions that were posed is essentially, you have an employee who calls their boss corrupt, says they should resign, the whole department's falling apart. Isn't your point really that the chief would have the discretion to place somebody on administrative leave and conduct an investigation.
And if in violation of the fire department rules and regulations, which that example would be in violation, yes, it would be reduce the good order and discipline, not just of these two members, but it's the example they set for all the two members
and,
as well.
And isn't this particular entity, like another law enforcement entity, and Justice Evans mentioned the term paramilitary, is there a difference in those types of entities and the need for discipline, the need for harmony, the need to lack, to not disrupt the work environment to suggest that administrative leave is a justified action pending an investigation?
Absolutely. The paramilitary organizations like the police, like fire department, rely on discipline. This discipline saves lives and property. Not only lives of officers and firefighters, but also of the public. You need to be able to trust your people to follow orders when they need to follow the orders, and especially in high-stress, high-risk situations. Now, in this case, I would argue that the free speech issues that are concerns that are brought from this court, it's more of a spectrum, right? So obviously, on one end of the spectrum, you have your citizens, you know, and government acting as sovereign, cannot, impede on their individual's right to free speech, especially like press and what. On the other end would be, okay, the most extreme would probably be national secrets or something like that, along those lines. Obviously, you can't divulge that. And along the way, you'll have military, you'll have paramilitary organizations in which these necessary elements are there for a reason, right? That no other county employees, are required to salute or wear uniform. I mean, it's not the same expectation that we put on someone in general services that takes out trash.
Well, and for that very reason, you've been advocating the Garcetti test for free speech retaliation. And doesn't that really focus less on the status of the person versus the substance and the context of what they're saying? And what you just said, I think, cuts against the Garcetti position.
Actually, in that, what Garcetti, what happened was, this was basically, here's something that he would have done as a prosecutor. And this I probably recall the memorandum or whatever that he prepared. And then he took it a step further, and it was an internal.
We know the facts, but I'm talking about the real substance. Literally, the substance is you're basing in a sort of a balancing of the speech itself, which I would agree with. It kind of depends on the speech versus the status of the individual, which Garcetti talks about when they're talking about official duty, official capacity, that first Garcetti prong, right?
I would agree that, especially in this case, that content was really not important. It was the conduct. I mean, these officers went, basically broke. And probably setting a horrible example for other firefighters.
But counsel, you're talking about the chain of command, is there to save lives and so on. I think no one would disagree with you on that. But at least Battalion Chief Loyola's letter and Battalion Chief Madero's letter, they said that the safety of the fire department was in jeopardy. They were screaming that we need help. Our number one has an incompetence problem. And he's putting everybody in jeopardy. Don't you want to encourage, especially at that rank, to speak up and not feel that you're going to get shot down by speaking up for the safety of the men and women of the fire department?
And that it's encouraged in the rules and regulations. That there is, it's actually in the rules and regulations that if you have ideas to help improve the department, please send out the chain.
Go to the chief that you're making the allegations against.
You're incompetent, and you don't have a strategic plan, and you didn't plan appropriately for a certain situation, and you're a terrible chief. That's what they should say directly to them.
Well, no, these are personal. Those are just personal attacks, right? And that is not for the benefit of anyone. Now, any legitimate
concerns. They were talking about preparedness, hurricanes, and no lack of plans,
right?
Manpower. but staffing issues and so on. So it sounded like logistics planning that jeopardized what they felt was jeopardizing the community.
And all except for, yes, the response to Hurricane Isabelle and Lisa and Loya's letter, there was some substantiation in that. Now, that is true of any incident. We're always learning, whether it's the police in an officer-involved shooting, or even if it's just as simple as a structure fire or a natural disaster, there's always going to be lessons learned.
The record doesn't really show whether previous complaints or issues were previously raised, right? Like whether internally issues had been raised previously.
Yes, the record is not fully developed in that area because the content itself was not what the MAB was addressing. They're addressing whether or not you can place somebody on paid administrative leave pending an investigation. And that's...
And you would agree with Mr. Hong along those lines that the MAB cannot consider constitutional issues.
I would agree they cannot consider constitutional issues. In fact, I had trouble finding any other than the Native Hawaiian case, the any case involving labor issues, you know, at an agency level tackling constitutional issues. I have not found any. I don't think Mr. Hong found any. The ACLU did not find any. All the cases cited were cases that were in courts that either went to summary judgment or went to trial. I mean, those.
But how would you address right? Mr. Hong's argument that, well, actually, perhaps it was yours. Under the primary jurisdiction, it was you that raised it. Like under the primary jurisdiction doctrine, then people would have to wait until. So you're saying primary jurisdiction does not apply to constitutional issues, so they could immediately sue in circuit court.
Well, I would agree that because this thought, took too long. And this took too long.
It seemed like the other lawsuit has just stayed. I'm assuming it's because of this appeal.
Yes. That's the only reason.
So there is claim preclusion issues that would be used.
That would be a possible claim preclusion issue. Yes.
I mean, why else would you stay?
That's why I argue that if anything, if for clarity, maybe this court can, for practitioners and courts, it's like, hey, once the agency made the decision, you can proceed. I mean, yes, they can appeal their decision. It might change things later on, but you need to move forward. And this is an extreme.
So you think like the whistleblower retaliation claims could have proceeded right after the Merits Appeals Board decision?
Yes, and discovery would have been done. You would have more developed record before us in discussing this basically probably the same issues other than those specific to the agency.
Mr. Disher, in this particular appeal coming up from the MAB to the circuit court, to the ICA, and to us, has there been argument by the petitioners as to specific statutes, rules, regulations, policies that have been violated?
Not that I'm
So it's all tied to the free speech constitutional issue?
Yes. So the basically, MAB said, hey, there was motions to dismiss on jurisdiction in the MAB as well. Arguably, after the fact, in hindsight 2020, MAB didn't really have jurisdiction to hear this matter in that the...
Well, MAB ruled that there was no adverse employment action.
Yes. If there's no adverse employment, there's no remedy, there's nothing that they could do. So arguably they didn't have it, but they heard it anyway, because they're also told to be very liberal with, you know, jurisdiction. It's like, hey, let's hear the cases anyway, and we'll make our decision. And that's what was happening. Now, the only time I would say a constitutional concern would be raised at an agency level under Chapter 91, because it does specify constitutional issues as well, would be to ensure that due process actually occurred at the agency level. That would be the oversight on the circuit court. Other than that, the circuit court would not step in and say, oh, now I'm going to find another constitutional issue to raise. But
let's say, I know this is kind of far-fetched, but let's say that while before everything kind of came down, some deputy chiefs at the Honolulu Police Department raised serious questions about the chief, Louis Kealoha. And they were placed on admin leave without pay. So
without pay?
I would leave with pay. So you're saying that they would just have to go through the map, but they would sue separately?
Now, the issue with just placing someone on leave with pay, I assume pending an investigation in that case, is that it's like a timeout. It's a temporary state in which you're placing someone on temporary leave pending an investigation. What comes out of the investigation is what it is. And then you decide whether or not an adverse employment action such as discipline is going to be imposed, whether it's a demotion, whether it's reassignment.
You're basically asking the law to say that anytime someone basically in a paramilitary type of state or county organization publicly criticizes the chief, it is completely fine to place that person on admin leave, and that in and of itself is not an adverse employment action.
The placement of somebody on leave with pay when they retain their benefits while pending investigation in and of itself is not an adverse employment action. Now,
even if these people routinely get overtime, and it's pretty clear they would have gotten overtime.
They need to be available for overtime now with administration.
And your argument is they're not available because they're on leave.
In other words,
they could just be placed on leave with pay for years and lose all that overtime, but there's no adverse employment action.
I would definitely disagree with any lengthy period.
What is the appropriate or okay length?
I would say it was case specific. In this case, there was a lengthy investigation, and that was the reason for the bill.
So if I can ask you, okay, so the struggle is, of course, understandably, that if there is corruption at the top, that there should be an ability of those under the supervising person to take some action. Now, in this case, Mr. Loyola did testify, as you mentioned, before the commission. And what was the difference there and why no action taken in that situation, as opposed to the letter that he wrote, which I believe was, was copied to the commission as well.
Right. So again, the record is not fully developed in the facts of surrounding that situation in which he testified in front of the commission.
In which he criticized the chief.
Now, I think maybe the analysis would be different if he showed up to the commission, he was on duty in uniform and saying, hey, as battalion chief, blah, blah, blah. That might be different than if he was off duty and speaking as a certain citizen on these matters, but does have unique knowledge to it. That might, again, be splitting hairs, but that's, I think a factual determination this was not done. Again, it's not like the actual content of the information is just the conduct. Now, he wasn't disciplined or put on paid administrative leave or anything regarding testifying to the BC Medeiros, also specified in the commission, but it was after while on administrative leave. Obviously, he was not chilled, he was not deterred. So, I think the difference is because of their rank, they have more influence in a department, and especially junior personnel. And when they're basically having a civil war within the department itself, there needs to be a need to restrain, get control back in the department. Good or ill, you would have a complete breakdown in a chain of command if every firefighter believed that they can, I don't need to follow what the chief said because, I heard what the chief said.
And I understand that there has to be some balance to maintain control and, make sure things don't get out of whack. But you had said earlier there was no loss of benefits, and Mr. Hong had mentioned that at least one of the battalion chiefs lost the use of a car. Is there a signed car that they had, and did they draw gas from the firehouse so they weren't paying out of pocket?
Not fully developed a record, but based on my experience and knowledge of not only the county and how it treats its official vehicles, if they had an official vehicle, which they probably had while on duty or because of their position, then that, I wouldn't say it's a benefit, actually.
It's a take-home vehicle.
I can't even say it's a take-home, but I believe it was. I cannot say that.
I understand. Thank you.
But that has its own, actually, their own tax implications for them, if they actually have a take-home.
But it could be viewed as a benefit.
I don't believe it's defined as a benefit.
It's not wear and tear on their own vehicle.
And it's not, I don't believe it's a benefit as outlined in the collective bargaining agreement.
All right. Want to wrap it up?
Yeah. Basically, yes, the county position is the, well, on paid administrative leave pending investigation, they retained their pay, their benefits. They were not demoted. It was not indefinite. Unfortunately, it was a long, I'll admit, long investigation, but the nature of the subject matter to be investigated did take a bit. And it was through a third-party investigator. There was no issue of bias of the investigator. So it had to run its course. And as soon as the investigation was done, Chief called them both back in. PC Madero's return. And the badges, again, it's symbols of the office. They were temporarily removed from the office. They were not demoted. And also that the fact alone that it's paid administrative leave, it's actually in the collective bargaining agreement. So actually, again, not a fully developed record, but I'm wondering how many junior firefighters under their commands have been placed on paid administrative leave pending investigation. That's also an interesting question for the career.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Hong, rebuttal?
Yeah, please. I just want to make two important points. The suggestion that my clients went rogue is a misstatement. It's a complete mischaracterization. So if you look at, for example, Kimo Lee, who was a fire commissioner, he said at docket 33, at looking at the base at 02630 all the way to 632, he said that as a fire commissioner, he invited them to the fire commission to speak about Chief Rosario and his ability. And that only not only went to Ty Medeiros, but also went to Steve Loyola. When you look at the fire commissioner, Carol Kitaoka, she wanted them to come to the commission to speak about their concerns because they were in the process of evaluating the chief. So the suggestion that somehow they woke up on the wrong side of the bed and decided to start shooting arrows at Chief Rosario is ridiculous because they were told to come to the fire commission to testify. The second point I want to make is to address your point exactly. I know that it was maybe said in terms of hyperbole, but to his credit, Ty Medeiros said exactly that to the chief. He met with the chief in person and told him all of that. He fulfilled his responsibilities. He said, you are incompetent. He said, you're endangering people. He said that in terms of Hurricane Izel, firefighters.
Is that in the record?
Yes. That's in Battalion Chief Medeiros' testimony.
Okay.
The other point I wanted to make very briefly about the investigation. Also in the testimony of Vic Vieira, former police chief, and also Chief Rosario. Chief Rosario was solely responsible for this particular investigation. He met with Vic Vieira personally and behind closed doors figured out what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. Nobody else had any information about that. That's in both their testimonies. And then finally, in terms of my clients, they were Muslim. They were Muslim. They couldn't speak. They were told expressly not to speak. And when you look at both letters placing them on investigative leave, the two points that they brought up are, one, you wrote the letter in terms of both my clients, and two, you talked to the fire commissioners. So when you talk about a chilling speech, you're talking about the fire commission who has that responsibility to manage, maintain, oversee a fire department in terms of that chain of command that we cited in the Alamos case. But they're saying that under their rules, you cannot speak to the fire commission. You are being placed on administrative leave with pay, denied regularly scheduled overtime, having your retirement benefits reduced because it's an average of your monthly salary or for a period of 5 years.
You didn't raise that below, right?
You're right, Your Honor. I put that in the reply brief. But in terms of my clients abusing their authority, if they had gone rogue, the argument could be made, yes, but they didn't go rogue. They were invited there, and that's clear in the record. And for some reason, the county never addresses that anywhere. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court may have.
All right. It does not appear there are any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
All right, at this time, how the court will take this matter under advisement. And before we leave, I'd like to say mahalo nui loa to the counsel, Ted Hong and Mark Disher, both graduates of the William S. Richardson School of Law, for participating, flying in from the Big Island to participate in oral argument this evening. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank the Richardson students, faculty and administrators, and welcoming us here tonight. It's always a treat to come back to my alma mater. Justice Edens and Justice Ginoza are also graduates of Richardson. And I'd like to thank the many folks who make tonight's possible. Dean Camille Nelson is not able to join us because she's on the continent, but I want to thank Dean Camille Nelson, Associate Dean Troy Andrade, and Associate Dean Sherry Larson for hosting us. And thank you also to Tracy Sir and Suman Gil, Stephen Park, and the student assistants, as well as from the judiciary, Kurt Shibata and James Kwan, for their hard work behind the scenes, turning this into a courtroom. And so we will be taking a brief recess, and then we look forward to meeting and speaking with the students. Thank you again for being here. Mahalo.
Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.